This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Some jurors wept, others looked angry, and one covered her face. That was the reaction in federal court today in the trial of admitted marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev.
Prosecutors rested their case, but not before a medical examiner testified in graphic detail and showed pictures of the bomb-inflicted wounds that killed 8-year-old Martin Richard almost 2 years ago. One of the bomb blasts caused massive injuries to his abdomen. Another nearly tore off his left arm.
Earlier in the day, another medical examiner described the fatal wounds suffered by BU student Lingzhi Liu. She bled to death on the street, one of three people killed by the bombs.
WBUR's Jack Lepiarz was at the Moakley Federal Courthouse and joins us now. And Jack, obviously some very tough testimony today from these medical examiners. Give us a sense of what the mood was like in the courtroom.
Well, I was talking with David Boeri, our reporter, who was watching the jury through this whole time, and he says he counted six jurors crying while some of these photos were being shown, and he said almost every juror had some sort of reaction. He said for some it was just this heavy breath before the photos were shown, almost just girding themselves to see this. For others, there was one woman, he said, who had her arms clenched on the arms of her chair, almost like she was bracing for impact. Another woman, like you said earlier, who was almost hiding her face, her hand covering her face from the gallery to sort of perhaps block us from seeing exactly what her reaction was.
Sure. So, Jack, the focus was on two victims, 8-year-old Richard Martin. Tell us more about what the medical examiner said in that case.
Well, the testimony on regarding Martin Richard was pretty tough to listen to. We heard from the chief medical examiner, Henry Neilds, and he essentially testified that there was no part of 8-year-old Martin Richard's body that did not have some kind of injury. And gruesome details that I won't go into here, but essentially, I mean, we heard about serious injuries to his chest, to his stomach. Third-degree burns on his legs, on his backside, as well as an arm that was almost completely separated. That's the kind of situation we heard about, and it's also the kind of situation that jurors saw in photographs. Those photographs were not shown to us in the gallery or to the public even after the trial.
Sure. Then, of course, there was testimony as well about the death of another young victim, the BU student Lingzhi Liu from China. What did we learn about her death?
Liu's injuries, we learned, were much more focused to her lower extremities. Liu, I mean, remember, as an adult, would be taller than an 8-year-old Martin Richard. But Liu had very similar injuries and a similar cause of death, which was essentially bleeding out. But she had a lot of debris in her legs, especially to the back of her legs, and her femoral artery, which is the main artery that carries blood to your legs, had been transected. Essentially, it had been cut. It had been severed. And that sort of situation. Prosecutors made sure to point out that she did have a minor bruise on her head, but it was not the kind of bruise that would cause her to lose consciousness. In other words, making the case that she was conscious, she could feel everything as it was happening, as she bled out in a few seconds to a couple minutes, as we heard in testimony today.
All right, well, that's reporter Jack Lepiarz of WBUR reporting from the Moakley Federal Courthouse in South Boston. Jack, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Let's turn now for more analysis from Rosanna Cavallaro. She's a Suffolk law professor who's been following the Tsarnaev trial closely. Rosanna, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So first of all, tell us what you think about how effectively the prosecution, or if they have been making their case effectively, that Jahar Tsarnaev is a jihadi and not a passive one. How convincing have they been?
Well, I think the evidence has been pretty strong, particularly in the last week where they highlighted the materials on different devices that he owned, how long he had had those materials, that it wasn't a latter day or short-term conversion, but that these were materials that he had access to, if not controlled himself, for close to a year, and that his behavior in and around the events was not just that of someone tagging along. That's the government's goal.
And do you think they have been convincing in that goal, in meeting that goal?
I think that it's been a strong case, but there's also been some highlights made by the defense as well. That is to say, as between the two brothers, who did what at each moment of this terrible, terrible series of events.
Right, because the defense seemed to go to lengths to say things like, you know, note that in the video images of the brothers walking down Boylston Street that it's Tamerlan Tsarnaev walking ahead of Jahar Tsarnaev, or the testimony of, I believe, Deng Meng, who was the man whose car was carjacked. It seemed like the defense in cross-examining him focused a lot on what did Tamerlan Tsarnaev do, not necessarily Jahar Tsarnaev.
That's right. I think what they're trying to do is lay the groundwork for something they're going to develop more fully in the penalty phase, which is that they want the jury to see this defendant as a relatively minor participant. Now, that's an important term because he's still obviously playing a terrible, significant role. But the question is whether his relatively minor participation should justify the jury's decision to spare his life. That's what the focus of the defense is.
Right. And you said, and that's what the focus of the defense will be in the penalty phase. And yet right now, we're still in the main portion of the trial phase, essentially. And the defense is now beginning to make its case. So what would they do or should they do right now?
Well, it's interesting. I think they're going to be trying to do as much as they can get away with, because much of this testimony really does not do anything to invite the jury to say he's not guilty. There's nothing they can say about his relatively minor role that would allow the jury to say, therefore, he's not guilty. But they're trying to sneak that in at this phase, kind of early and often, and then pick it up in the second half. So when it's their turn to offer evidence, as it is now, it's not clear that the judge is going to allow them to go very far down that road. He may say you need to wait for the penalty phase because this stuff doesn't really undercut his guilt, and that's what the question for the jury in this first round is.
And this is a question that they still have to answer officially, even though Judy Clark on the defense team in opening statement said he did it. You know, I'm just curious about one thing, or actually about several things. But one of them is that I see that Harvard Law professor Ron Sullivan made a point that the defense's argument could backfire because there's a thin line between explaining what happened and then, you know, it perhaps coming across in the jurors' minds as excusing. Is that a risk that the defense team runs here?
I think so. I think with a crime of this gravity, there's a human desire to see someone sort of step up and own it and take that responsibility. And I don't know what the defense's plan is in that regard. That is, the counsel has acknowledged his responsibility, but there is that sort of subtext of will he himself acknowledge it? And part of that is just, I think, reading his affect and his demeanor.
Yeah, you know, we've also heard defense team members hint at the fact that, especially during penalty phase, as you said, we're going to hear a lot more about Tsarnaev's story. And I presume, as you mentioned, they're going to once again put a lot of focus on the elder brother, Tamerlan Tsarnaev. But how much can they do that and lose the opportunity of trying to humanize, as much as that might be possible, Jahar Tsarnaev himself? Because I'm reading that one of the goals in keeping someone away from the death penalty in cases like this is to humanize them in front of a juror's eyes.
Very much so. And I think the idea here, the goal here, is to humanize him as a recognizable character, that is, a younger brother who is in a time of emotional turmoil, parents, etc., sort of a chaotic home environment, who has this very dominant personality in the household who might be having an undue influence on him. And so a story that the jury can find plausible and relate to and yet also hold him responsible in an important way.
And finally, in this phase of the trial that we're currently in, you know, before the penalty phase begins, the defense is going to be making some kind of case, and that opens the door to aggressive cross-examination, I presume, from prosecutors. So do you imagine the defense is going to be putting up a vigorous case now before we finally get to the penalty phase, or keeping it short?
Well, again, I think, I don't know their list of witnesses, but I'm guessing that it would be witnesses who would try to highlight the defendant's general behavior as an ordinary average person, you know, the person who might have said to the carjacking victim, can I hook my iPhone up and hear my music? So an ordinary teenager. And I think, I don't know that the judge is going to let them do that at the guilt phase, because as I said, it is not going to demonstrate that he's not guilty. So the cross-examination of witnesses like that is not terribly problematic. They're just, you know, ordinary friends and acquaintances.
Well, Rosanna Cavallero is a professor of law at Suffolk Law School. Thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Coming up, the dedication of the Edward M. Kennedy Institute for the U.S. Senate and the legacy of the Senate's liberal lion. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.